When film critic Roger Ebert was in Madison for the Wisconsin Film Festival, he introduced A Hard Day's Night to a festival audience. It's one of the 100 movies featured in Ebert's book, The Great Movies. While he was here, I had the chance to speak to him. Ebert talked about the influence that A Hard Day's Night has had.
Essentially, stylistically, the director, Richard Lester, ushered in music videos, MTV, and a whole style of photographing pop music with that movie. I think there's a real break between A Hard Day's Night and what went before.
Do you think he knew what he was doing when he put that together?
You know, sometimes when a really great film is made, it's kismet. Although kismet was not a great film. Everything falls into place, and later people are astonished at what they did. For example, nobody knew when they were making Casablanca that it would be an immortal film. And when they were making Bonnie and Clyde and finished it, the studio didn't even want to release it. And I think in the same way, United Artists, which was the producing studio for Hard Day's Night, didn't even care about the movie. They only wanted to release the soundtrack because they frankly thought the Beatles might be over with by the time the movie was edited and released. You know, they thought they were a flash in the pan. And Richard Lester was a director who had done a lot of commercials and television. He worked fast. The budget was $500,000, which even in 1963 wasn't very much money. Yet here is this great, original, bracing, energetic, upbeat film that resulted.
All these are wonderful words, but what made it different from the movies that were being made at the time? What made it stand out?
Well, for one thing, it didn't take the musicians seriously in the same way that other rock musicals had. The Elvis movies, for example, or Rock Around the Clock with Bill Haley or other films like that. Some of the Beach Party movies, which dealt with Frankie Avalon. The Beatles were allowed to be grown up, quirky, irreverent, offensive. There are a lot of one-liners in the movie that are relatively daring.
You know, what surprised me about A Hard Day's Night when I saw it for the first time was wondering whether anybody could possibly be having that much fun. Could they really be in character? Could that be these four young men?
Well, I think so. I think that when they shot it in late 63, very early 64, being a Beatle was still fun for the Beatles. In 1963, Paul McCartney would have been 21, turning 22, very young. And I think you can see in the movie, they grin at each other while they're singing. They're kind of still delighted to be chased by screaming girls. They like the energy of their fans. It hadn't all become a burden for them, a kind of an existential, you know, the weight of fame on their shoulders, so they had to go to India and meditate in order to deal with it. When this movie was made, it was all new and it was all fun, and I think they were having fun.
Is that part of the appeal 30 years later, 40 years later?
40 years later. You know, I said in my introduction last night, this movie is now twice as old as Casablanca was when it came out. When Hard Day's Night came out, Casablanca was 20 years old, and we thought of it as an old movie. And now this movie is 40 years old, and most of the people in the audience were born since the movie was made, but yet it could have been made yesterday. It hasn't dated as some older movies do. I think it's as fresh as it ever was.
I wondered, though, for a generation of Beatles fans, whether knowing what was to come for them is part of the appeal of watching this film from their youth.
Well, of course, I think that's probably so. I like the film very much. I've written about it. I've seen it many times. I've even taught it a shot at a time. But there were people there last night who were telling me what month the movie had to have been made in because of the fact that George Harrison was playing one guitar and not another guitar. And he only bought that guitar in November of 64.
Do film fans drive you crazy sometimes?
Well, no, not the ones last night. They were the ones last night. There was one guy last night who really knew his stuff. And he told me a story that I said I was going to rip off and claim as my own the moment I left Madison. You know the overhead shot of the Beatles running around in the field? The camera operator who shot that, got into the helicopter, which they only had for an hour or so, and they took off, and he realized he had left his extra battery on the ground. And he was distraught, but he kept filming until the battery ran down. Well, of course, as the battery was running down, the film was moving slower and slower through the gate. And, of course, when you undercrank like that, then it creates the effect of fast motion when you play it at ordinary speed. And so the end of that shot, which Lester left in and loved, was serendipitous. It was a fast motion because the battery was running down. So there are people who know everything about this film.
Kismet once again.
Yeah.
The great shot. That, though, is not, I think, the great shot that you mention in your book about this, which the comment on this is...
The little blonde girl, yes. Or on public radio, the young blonde woman. or the young fair-haired woman. When they do their concert at the end of the film in the television studio, Lester begins with a shot of the fans being ecstatic to see the Beatles go on stage, and then he denies us another close-up of those fans for a long time. He doesn't just cut in routinely. It's a very interesting editing decision to make us then delay and wait until the final song of the set. And then he cuts into this incredible montage of the screaming fans, most of them girls, although we now know that Phil Collins was in that audience too, but mostly about 98% girls. And there are four or five shots of this one particular young girl who finally, at the end, is just hopelessly, there are tears running down her face, and she's reaching out and she's saying, "George, George." And when I see that girl, it's like Daisy, you know, Gatsby's Daisy, or it's like the young woman with the white parasol in Citizen Kane. Not a year has gone past since I saw the movie when I haven't thought about that girl.
We've talked about A Hard Day's Night, mm-hmm. which is one of your many favorite films. You are also here in Madison to talk about and lead a discussion, in fact, about a film called Better Luck Tomorrow.
Yes.
I know nothing about this film. Can you tell me what it is?
Well, I saw it at the Sundance Film Festival in 2002. And it's directed by Justin Lin. It's about a group of young Asian Americans, mostly Chinese Americans, second or third generation, totally assimilated, if that's the word, who live in a very affluent area of California, probably in Orange County. The first shot of the movie shows the gates opening on their gated community. They come from affluent families. They're getting very good grades. They're all headed for the Ivy League. They're very good in science, very good in math, very good at computers, very, very smart and ambitious, so that the hero, tries out for the basketball team because he thinks that will look good on his resume, even though he doesn't care about basketball. And they get involved in selling the answers to exams. And then their life of crime escalates from there to a really horrifying degree. And what's interesting is the moral disconnect in which they do extremely evil things and don't think of them as evil or don't really get involved in them. It's kind of like the suburban teenager as ambitious, self-centered, narcissistic monster. And I think Justin Lin made this movie as kind of a critique of a certain segment of young Asian American overachieving teenagers. But you'd have to ask him about that. The important thing about the movie is it's not just an independent film that played at Sundance. It's really one of the great American films of the year, and it's probably going to go on my list of the 10 best films of the year. Justin Lin is an important new director. When he came along with this film, I kind of felt I was going to be hearing more from him in the next 5 or 10 years.
What is it in your mind that makes the difference between a good film and a great film? I know you've been asked that question 100 times, but listening to you talk about Better Luck Tomorrow, I wondered, because you talk entirely about the story.
Yeah.
No discussion so far of why a movie of that story should be better than your relation of that story, or that story as printed in a book or told
right.
around a campfire.
Right. Very good point. You know, if you say, "I saw a film last night," they immediately say, "What's it about?" They don't say, "What was the visual style?"
Right.
Justin Lin manages to place these people in an environment that has no adults except for a couple of teachers who have very small roles, no parents. He shows them in a very sterile, materialistic environment, dominated by consumer goods, automobiles, clothes, sunglasses, cell phones, and he photographs them as if it's an ad sometimes, except that it's an ad that doesn't have any heart or any product to sell. They're kind of stuck. They already have the products, and the products aren't really doing much for them. He also has a screenplay. He wrote the screenplay that doesn't pay off in any ordinary sense. It's not about people going wrong and creating crimes, and then there's a climax, and you know they're either caught or they're not caught. It's more about their interior weather, about the morality that's expressed by their behavior. And the ending is as cynical and as harsh, really, as any film I've seen. He makes no attempt at all to pacify the audience with some kind of conventional, obligatory happy ending.
It seems to me that this is the challenge, maybe the blessing for a reviewer like you, who primarily writes about movies. Now, of course, you've made a huge reputation by being able to show clips as well.
I
wish you started writing only.
Oh, yeah. I still spend 85% of my time as a writer.
Which means you have to be able to find words to describe what a scene is all about.
You try to. When I review this movie, I hope I'm equal to it. I'm going to see it for the third time tonight.
Well,
you know, some films, once is more than enough, but others, you want to go back to them.
I read in a review, I think, of Roger Ebert, The Great Movies, that you, when watching a film for review, avoid the trailers like the plague.
I prefer not to see the trailer. If I've read the book that the movie is based on, that's fine. But if I haven't read it, I don't go out and read it. Because the movie really has to work as a movie. You know, it's not like a marriage where we have to determine if the movie is faithful to the book or if some kind of fictional adultery has taken place.
It seems to me to relate what we were just talking about, though, because you show a clip as part of your review on the television show that you do. A clip can be perhaps representative of a whole, less so than a trailer, but still it's only a clip.
Yeah, well, you know, there's that whole problem that's talked about on the web of spoilers. Do you tell me so much in the review that you'll give away things that I should find out for myself? It's difficult for a critic to know how much to tell and how much not to tell. I really didn't tell a lot about the end of Better Luck Tomorrow. But then again, you know, there's always the apocryphal story about the critic who was criticized for giving away the ending of Last Temptation of Christ. It's tough. I kind of would really prefer for people to read my reviews after seeing the movie, you know. And that's one of the, perhaps the only purpose of thumbs and stars, because I think rating systems are enormously silly, giving a movie 3 stars or 4 stars or thumbs up. But everybody does. I was stuck with the stars because all the other newspapers give stars. And so my editors want me to give stars. But at least you can see from that rating, superficially, what the critic thinks about it. Or you can go to RottenTomatoes.com and see how it scored on the tomato meter, which is actually more useful than it might sound. Yeah. I wish that instead of giving 4 stars in the Chicago Sun-Times, that we had a 5-star system. Because then you could have a true middle position. There are a lot of movies that you're in the middle on. You don't love them, you don't hate them. You're kind of in the middle on them. And the 4-star system requires you or forces you to jump one way or the other.
Even 2.5 is not...
2.5 is not quite there.
Film critic Roger Ebert. He spoke to me when he was here in Madison for the Wisconsin Film Festival. Ebert is the best-known movie critic in America. He won the Pulitzer Prize for Criticism in 1975. He's the author of The Great Movies.